Thank you, Yuan. First of all, thank you for inviting me here. It's been great. I've been to Perimeter once or twice before, but this is my first time giving a talk here. Yeah, it's very nice to be here.
PIUIUC.
Yeah, we have PIUIUC meetings every year. So yeah, it was great being there, but it's also nice to give a talk here. Okay, so the title of my talk is basically about the mother of all states of the Kagome. It sounds a bit catchy, but I intend to communicate that there's a very simple idea here that was missed for many, many years. And that really helps understand a lot of the complexities that have been associated with this very controversial question about the Kagome antiferromagnet. I won't jump into it right away because this is the first time I'm giving a talk and I would like to explain what other kinds of things I do. The two works that I will be presenting are with Brian Clark and Eduardo Fradkin and Krishna Kumar, who is our graduate student. Brian Clark is an assistant professor at Urbana-Champaign. And Eduardo Fradkin, who you know everyone knows, has written a very nice field theory textbook. And the second paper that was written also had Dima Kochkov, who is a very bright young grad student. He did a lot of the numerics for it. So this is still under review. I'm currently at Hopkins, but most of this work was done at Urbana-Champaign. In particular, I'd like to thank the supercomputers at the Blue Waters facility in Illinois, without which this work would be truly impossible. Okay. So, this is the first time I'm giving a talk here. Not too many people know me, so I'd like to just give a broad objective of things I do. Okay? So, I basically study systems of many particles. They could be bosons, electrons, or spins. I'm generally interested in the regime where the interactions are very, very strong, so you cannot really think of it in a conventional mean field sense. Okay? And that is basically the field of strongly correlated systems, which people at PI know very, very well. Okay, one of the simplest questions we are asking is, if you go to absolute zero temperature, what is the ground state of the system? And if you're a bit more ambitious, you can also try to understand what are the excited states and what is their functional relationship with the ground state. And that also brings me to some recent foray into finite temperature properties of these systems. For the purpose of this talk, I'll often just stick to the zero temperature properties, the lowest energy properties of these systems. So, this can be done in many, many ways. Okay? There's a whole huge community of material science which wants to understand these strongly correlated systems from a very ab initio perspective, from, you know, just go to the material directly, do not make too many assumptions, and try to understand what are the properties of these exotic, for example, superconductors. And then there's a community that adopts a more phenomenological approach, saying that, okay, the important physics is really in the model Hamiltonians. And you can go on further and say, okay, we are really interested in the long-range properties of these materials, so we want to develop some sort of field theory for it. Okay? But really, as a condensed matter theorist, my wish list includes how would I go systematically from this very micro description involving lots of ions, lots of electrons, figure out which electrons, which part of Hilbert space is important so that I can come up with a simplified description of the problem. And if I'm a bit more ambitious, I can try to develop a field theory for it. So this is in principle possible. I've developed a lot of efforts in this direction. On the material side, for example, I collaborated with Lucas Wagner at Urbana-Champaign. On the model side, again, with Eduardo Fradkin and Brian Clark. And on the field theory side, it was Vicente Ryu, who was at Urbana, now at Chicago. So just to emphasize my point a little bit more, there's a Walter Cohn school of thought, and there's an Anderson school of thought on the right. The Walter Cohn school of thought says, okay, you know, you just work with the full Schrodinger equation with all the electrons in the problem. The problem is that the important physics is not so obvious. And in the Anderson school of thought, the important physics sort of emerges, but you don't know really whether it maps onto some realistic material or not. Okay? So both have their advantages, both have their cons. I'm going to be focusing on the model side of things for the purpose of this talk. Because the models themselves become fairly interesting And one particular model that has, you know, caught the imagination of a lot of people is a model on a Kagome lattice. So what is a Kagome lattice? Well, before I get on to that, I'd just like to say that, as I was saying, that model Hamiltonians, there have been several techniques to solve these model Hamiltonians. People at PI are very familiar with DMRG and tensor networks. For the purpose of today's talk, I'm just going to be focusing on exact diagonalization approach to solving these model Hamiltonians. Okay, so that will basically be my talk. I'm going to explain why are these model Hamiltonians interesting and what is it about frustrated magnetism on the Kagome lattice that is interesting. And then I'm going to go on to a more specific subtlety about the Kagome lattice, where we discovered an exactly solvable point on the Kagome lattice that was missed for several years. So these are really two intertwined parts that I'm going to be talking about. And the second part is basically the title, you know, will justify the title of my talk. So please interrupt me if you have any questions. This is sort of a general overview of things I do. Okay, so frustrated magnetism. It's as simple as it sounds. You take a simple Hamiltonian of spins, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and you can put it on a square lattice, you can put it on a triangular lattice, and right away you recognize that there's a problem. You know, you cannot satisfy the up-down antiferromagnetic rule on a triangular lattice. And a more refined version of that is on a Kagome lattice, which is a lattice of corner-sharing triangles. So the central question that I'm asking is, which state wins in energy? And often there's no single winner. One needs a full many-body treatment of this problem. Okay, so this is just not something that an artist conceived, oh, we want to study the Kagome lattice for a reason. The reason we want to study it is because there are actual experimental materials out there. For example, Herbert Smithite is a lattice of corner-sharing triangles on the Kagome geometry with copper and oxygen ions in two-dimensional planes. So here I'm showing two-dimensional planes of copper and oxygen. You can see that the blue ions are the copper, the red ions are the oxygen, and assuming the oxygen are the high energy degrees of freedom, we have triangular like lattices. And then in the third direction, you have zinc ions, which are non-magnetic. So these are essentially two-dimensional, with the third dimension being acting like a buffer between these 2D planes. So the interesting theoretical question from here on, I will just talk about theory, no more experiment. The interesting theoretical question is, why is there no symmetry breaking, or why is there no observed magnetic ordering down to very, very low temperatures? Why is there a spin liquid at very, very low temperatures in this very simple model on the Kagome lattice? So already you can start thinking about this problem completely classically. If you think of spins as semi-classical vectors sitting on a triangular lattice, sitting on a Kagome lattice, you can start looking at these, you can start looking at these triangular motifs. Each of these triangular motifs satisfies the minimum energy condition. So three spins that want to minimize their energy want to be at 120 degrees with respect to each other. So on the Kagome lattice, in fact, this can be done in exponentially many ways. Okay? There's not one way, there's not two ways, there's not three ways, there's exponentially many ways. So you increase the system size, there is more and more and more ways in which you can satisfy the semi-classical condition. Okay, so here I'm just showing two of the many, many low energy states that you can have semi-classically. The one on the left is called the Q equal to zero state, and the one on the right actually has a 9-site unit cell. I intend to show the unit cell by these dotted circles. So these three triangles, they form part of a unit cell, whereas here the unit cell just repeats on each triangular motif. So this has a 3-site unit cell, and this has a 9-site unit cell. Okay, so this is a completely semi-classical treatment. But there is work done arguing that now if you account for quantum mechanical effects, you could lift the degeneracy between all these states. Okay? And the answer is not so trivial. So if you take, again, this Kagome lattice, which has several low-lying states all having the same energy semi-classically, there can be many phases that arise from this competition. The one that has captured people's imagination is a spin liquid, an exotic phase of matter that is basically, you can think of it as some superposition of many magnetically ordered states. So each one of these has magnetic long-range order. If you have a spin pointing up here, if you have a spin pointing up here, a very far off spin also has an up spin. So very far off, spins are basically just perfectly correlated and they're long-range order. However, if you take a superposition of all these sort of configurations, you could lose the magnetic long-range order. So locally, you do not have any order parameter to distinguish between these phases, between these states, and you basically form a macroscopic superposition which does not show any evidence of symmetry breaking. Yet, because it's a macroscopic superposition of many states, there's long-range entanglement. Okay? Okay. Any questions about this very general framework for spin liquid? I know a lot of people are very familiar, but I just wanted to make sure everyone was on the same page as I went along in my talk. Okay, so this should be one of my last few introduction slides about this particular problem. Okay, so if I now consider the Heisenberg Hamiltonian on the spin half, the spin half Heisenberg Hamiltonian on the Kagome lattice, which is extremely quantum mechanical, because as I go to larger and larger spins, quantum effects become less and less important. There has been a controversy that has been raging for almost three decades by this point. There is this first proposal by Sachdev and also followed up by Weidelzer, who did the numerics, who suggested that there's a spin liquid in this particular system. That was sort of refuted by Marsden and Zeng and Senthil, who discovered a very competitive state which actually broke lattice symmetry, it broke translational symmetry, and it was a valence bond solid with very similar energy to the spin liquid. This problem quietened down, things were a bit more quiet over the 15 years or so, till there was a resurgence of interest. So David Hughes found, in 2007 with Rajiv Singh, found again evidence for valence bond solid based on series expansions, so a certain kind of numerical technique. And then again, David Hughes in 2011 sort of flipped about this and said, hey, there should be a spin liquid. This was done with the DMRG work of Steve White. Okay? Now, there's excellent work done here at Perimeter as well with multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. That was by Giffre Vidal, who said that there should, again, be a spin valence bond solid. So there's been a lot of back and forth on this issue. Now, the reason is not because people are doing something wrong. The reason is that there are extremely competitive energies in an extremely small energy window. So what I'm showing here is the energy per site, and what I'm showing here is the system size, or rather the inverse system size. So as you go towards the left, you're going towards the thermodynamic limit, and as you're towards the right, you're on smaller systems. So if you take the exact diagonalization results of Andreas Leuschli and Eric Sorensen, and you go towards larger lattice size, you see that at some point, you know, the energy goes from something very negative to something that is closer to 0.438. The MERA results are somewhere higher, minus 0.432. It's not so much higher, it's about 0.1-0.2% higher. And then there are the latest DMRG results, or rather not, I mean, from 2011, which are somewhere here. So in this very small energy window, there are many, many states. Okay? So that's why there has been this back and forth. Okay? So you may say, okay, everything has been solved, why should we do anything more on this problem? Well, the reason is the following. There has been further work by Zalatel and Jin-Chin He, and also by Xiaogang Wen, arguing that the nature of this phase, even though it's a spin liquid, is far from well established. Okay? So I'll get to that in the second part of my talk, but I just want to emphasize that this problem, even though you can get very accurate energies, people have still not nailed down what is the qualitative nature of the phase yet. Okay. Okay. So I was a postdoc, and some very smart people had worked on this problem, so I was completely avoiding that problem. Rather, what I did was I took a slightly different route towards this problem. The first thing I did explore was I changed the Hamiltonian. Okay? So instead of working with the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, I took the XXZ Hamiltonian. So in the XXZ Hamiltonian, you have JZ, SZZ, which is the Ising term. You have the XY term. And we also considered the effect of a magnetic field. Now, this is not so crazy, because there have been proposals, there have been other DMRG studies, which in a magnetic field saw plateaus. So these plateaus are sort of metastable states, which the system gets locked into as you change the magnetic field going through the system. Okay? And in these plateaus were typically studied at the Heisenberg point. So typically, these plateaus are associated with some symmetry broken states. However, we had the insight that if you change JZ, okay, you are making the spin somewhat more quantum, because this is the quantum fluctuations. This is the term that encodes the quantum fluctuations. This term encodes sort of, in some sense, you can think of it as the repulsion between, in a bosonic language. So here you are confining the bosons. Okay, so this makes it less quantum. So if you can reduce this term, you might be able to find a spin liquid even in a magnetic field. Okay? That's the sort of hunch that we were starting off with. And this is not so crazy, because people have been doing experiments in magnetic fields. So one day this might be realized even in practice. For now, I'm just going to focus on the theoretical aspect of whether a spin liquid can exist in one of these plateau states. Okay? So, what we were motivated by was a field theoretic study by Eduardo Fratkin and his student Krishna Kumar. And what they argued is that if I take this Kagome lattice in a magnetic field, I can develop an emergent spin current. Okay? So this spin current basically breaks time reversal symmetry. Okay? And if I patch many of these pieces together, okay, so I patch a piece of spin current here, piece of spin current here, and so on. And if I look at it in an RG sort of sense, so if I look at this from very, very far, the spin currents basically just cancel out between different hexagons. So what I'm looking at is just effectively, at very, very large length scales, I'm just looking at an effective edge current associated with the system. Okay, so because I have some local chirality developed, and because I have this RG way of sort of looking at it, the only real low energy excitation is associated with the edge of the system. Okay? So the prediction is that on a torus geometry, there will be two low energy states associated. One of them will be the ground state, and the other will be the edge state, which also has low energy. Now, these ideas were actually developed by Giffre Vidal and Andreas Ludwig in a very nice Nature Communications paper from 2014. However, I would like to point out that they explicitly added chirality into the Hamiltonian. It was a very different Hamiltonian. It was not in a magnetic field. It was in zero field. Okay? But essentially, the ideas transfer on into a completely different Hamiltonian, different model, different field, different filling. But the idea is essentially the same, that there is a chiral spin liquid emerge with a low-lying edge state on a torus geometry. Okay, so we were equipped with certain numerical tools to deal with them. And the numerical tool was just exactly diagonalize the system. Okay, so we took one of our large clusters. This is a 42B cluster, as we call it, or as is called in the literature. You diagonalize the system. And sure enough, you do this in several momentum sectors. Sure enough, you see some low-lying two states. Okay? Now, of course, just because you have two states doesn't mean that they're topological. You need to do a lot more to establish that. But at least this is a good starting point. Are there any questions till this point? Or I'm happy to. Yeah. Okay. So what we did is, these two states should also be locally indistinguishable. That's another criterion to have a topological spin liquid. So we did this for several finite clusters, and we measured the chirality. So we measured a three-spin correlation function, SI dot SJ cross SK, on triangles. Okay? And the system is translationally invariant, so you can measure it on any triangle you want. And sure enough, up to finite size effects, we saw that the chiral expectation value, sorry, I'm not very good at using this, the chiral expectation value was nearly the same, within 5 to 10%, as we went across the clusters. Okay? So if you take state 1 and state 2, the chiral expectation value is 0.067 and 0.060, which up to finite size effects is not a big effect, okay, given that these clusters are extremely small. So that was a second criterion that made us believe, OK, hey, there may be really a chiral spin liquid out here. What we did next was we mimicked Laughlin's flux pumping experiment on a computer. So what did Laughlin tell us about chiral spin liquids? He said, hey, if you take a chiral spin liquid on a cylinder and you apply a spin current in one direction, you generate a magnetic flux. And what that magnetic flux does, it transports a quasi-particle from one end of the cylinder to the other. Okay? So the way this manifests itself on a computer is that you start with two low-lying states here. They are in different momentum sectors. You apply a twist boundary condition in one direction. And you see that as you evolve from 0 to 2 pi, the states start, then they cross, then they go here. State starts, crosses, goes here. Note that they're in two different momentum sectors, so you could easily track them. So what has happened is that even though you have gone from 0 to 2 pi, you have not come back to yourself. You started with the black one down, the red one up. You have gone to red down and black up. So the system looks like it has come back to itself. But really, you would have to do another 2 pi twist to get back to yourself truly. Okay? So that is evidence of some fractional statistics in the system. Okay? That is what Laughlin taught us to do, that you need to count how many such cycles do you need to go till the system comes back to itself. OK, so that's not the only criterion, because what you also need to ensure is that these two states are the only two states that can talk to each other or that can mix from one into the other. So what we explicitly checked is we did several cross-sections. In fact, we considered a whole 2D zone of twists, because as I said, we considered, so here I just showed a cylinder, which you just had one twist, but we really did our calculations on tori, which had twists in both directions. So you had a twist in X and a twist in Y direction. So what we explicitly checked is that this entire high energy manifold is really gapped out from these two states. And these two states are the ones that cross into each other. Okay? So that is an important criterion for topological order to be stable, because if you have mixture from the high energy states, you will destroy the topological order on adding some perturbations or putting some spin current through the system or putting some magnetic fields through the system. Okay? So one has to explicitly check that there is really no interference from this high energy manifold that is interfering with the spin liquid physics. This can be verified also via measuring the Berry curvature. So what we did is we measured the Berry curvature, which is basically you take this 2D space of twist angles and you compute this quantity called the Chern number, the many-body Chern number. So we are generally used to calculating the Chern number for bands in a non-interacting sense. But really, this is with a whole set of many-body wave functions. So what we did is we did an exact diagonalization and computed several wave functions at each and every point in the space of twist angles. Okay? And for each one of these, we computed the Berry curvature or Berry phase, rather, locally. Okay? So what we did is we started from 1, calculated the wave functions, went to 2, 3, went to 4, and we came back to ourselves. And the phase that you pick up after going from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 is the berry phase. Okay? Now you can integrate this berry phase over this entire 2D twist space of twist angles. Analogously, in a non-interacting setting, you would have integrated over momenta, 2D momenta. But here you're integrating over twist angles because this is a we have only many body wave functions. We don't have some non-interacting picture to think about this very concretely. And what we showed is that here I'm mapping out the Berry curvature as function of twist angles, where it's blue is very low Berry curvature, where it's high, the Berry curvature is very high. And if you'd like to think about the non-interacting version of this, if you have two bands that are crossing, all the Berry curvature generally comes from crossings in energy space. So what we are showing here is the many-body energy levels. So this is the non-interacting picture. You have E versus K. But what I'm showing here is I'm showing the many-body energies. So I have many-body energies in some parameter space, right, that are crossing at some point. And that is causing the high Berry curvature. So what I'm showing here is the energy gap between the lowest two states in the same momentum sector as a function of twist angles. And wherever the energy levels touch is where the Berry curvature is highest. Now, just like the non-interacting setting, you can add a term that explicitly breaks time reversal symmetry. For example, you can explicitly add a chiral term, just like Giffre does. And you can basically introduce a churn number here. So this will become like a C equal to plus 1, C equal to minus 1, depending on what sign of chirality you introduce. So you explicitly introduce a gap, and you create a churn number for each one of the bands. The equivalent here is that you do not see this region of high Berry curvature anymore, and this Berry monopole, as we call it, spreads out. Okay? So what I'm showing here is the distribution of the Berry curvature. Again, we have several grid points, and we're just mapping them out in this space of 2D twist angles, theta 2 and theta 1. And this Berry monopole has effectively spread out. But the important thing is that the integral of the Berry curvature is still an invariant. And that is the many-body churn number. So the many-body churn number earlier was also half. And the churn number now is also half. So really, this is a topologically invariant quantity. Okay? That is characterizing this phase. We should have stopped there, but we continued on. We also calculated certain field theoretic modular matrices. This is another detailed discussion, which I'm not going to get into. But you can essentially look at the papers of Ashwin Vishwanath, Giffre, and also Duncan Haldane, who basically computed some effective quasi-particle statistics. Because we are just doing an exact diagonalization calculation, but eventually we'd like to understand the field theoretic. We'd like to understand it from a field theoretic perspective as to what are the effective quasi-particles in the system. So to make that map connecting the many-body numerics to what the field theorists would like to see, which is these modular transformations, which basically encode the self-statistics and the mutual self-statistics of the system, there's a very concrete way of doing it. In the interest of time, I'm not going to discuss all the details, but I'm just going to say that there's a very nice agreement between what we found theoretically by computing these modular transformations and what we saw with an exact diagonalization. So we are fairly convinced that we have several pieces of evidence for a chiral spin liquid. And we should have stopped there. And this sort of brings me to the second part of my talk, which is also the title of my talk.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sure.
In the model that consider yes. chiral symmetry is spontaneously broken.
Yes.
So how many ground states are there? Are there only two or four?
So there should be, yeah, that's a very good question. There should be four ground states, but only when, so this is a finite size problem. So there should ideally be four ground states, right? There should be chirality plus chirality plus chirality minus, and they should all be exactly degenerate, right? But what happens is that there are severe finite size effects, which is why there's some spontaneously time reversal symmetry breaking happening in the model. So what we see is we see, for example, C equal to plus here and another state with chirality plus here, and another state with chirality minus here, and another state with chirality minus here. So these two are topologically related, and these two are topologically related. So what we do is we explicitly add a small chiral term to make these closer in energy and to make these further in energy. This manifold further in energy from this. But the chirality is small, and we think that if one went truly to the thermodynamic limit, one should see all four states. So that was a subtlety I sort of glossed over, but it's a very good question because we spent a lot of time breaking our heads over it. Yeah, you really should be seeing four states if you don't break any time reversal. But we add a small time reversal symmetry breaking term to gap out this manifold. And it can be a little bit cluster specific. So our paper actually discusses this at some length. But I didn't want to complicate the talk by getting into this issue. But it's a very good question, actually. Are there any other questions? OK, so I can get to the second part of my talk. I don't know how much time I have. It's about 11:35. Okay, so another 20 minutes. Yeah. Okay, so that brings me to the second part of my talk. And ideally, we should have just said, okay, we are very happy. We've developed some way of looking at spin liquids. We've borrowed a lot from the literature, but we've applied it to a new problem. And hey, we found a new spin liquid. Spin liquids are not so common in nature. They were pretty rare. Well, we should have been happy, but we were not. We wanted to understand, why is there a spin liquid in the first place in all these problems? So what we did is I showed you that we were changing JZ and we were looking at the low energy spectrum. We went to JZ, which is, again, the Ising term. We went to JZ, which was negative. Okay? So instead of going to positive JZ, that is conventionally done in the literature, we went to JZ that is negative. And when JZ is negative, we found that there is a point on the phase diagram where the energy is exactly minus J by 4. Just in case you're looking at this axis, it just says energy 0, but that's because I just shifted by some constant just to make the visualization easier. But if you look at the absolute energy of the XXZ model at JZ equal to minus half, it's exactly minus 1/4. Okay? So at minus half is. So there was something mysterious about this. We thought, okay, I mean, this result just has to exist in the literature. Why don't we know this? Well, turns out that the result was not known, even though it's extremely simple. And what is the result? Well, you take any, after some investigation, what we realize is that you take any lattice of corner-sharing triangles involving triangular motifs. That could be a sawtooth lattice, Kagome lattice, triangular lattice, Shastri-Sutherland lattice, with this diagonal coupling to be double that of these guys. So it's basically like two pasted triangles here. Okay. You take the icosy dodecahedron, which is a 30-site molecule. It's basically like a Kagome lattice on a sphere. Or you take the hyper-Kagome lattice, okay, which also is known to harbor a spin-liquid phase in three dimensions. Any three-colorable lattice with this Hamiltonian, with this ratio of JZ by J, has exact ground states. I can write down the ground states exactly. Okay. And to the best of my knowledge, this was not reported. So we decided to do something about it. Okay. So what is really happening? Okay. So you take a single triangle first. Okay. And you go to this point, JZ by J is equal to minus half. JZ is minus half J. Okay. So JZ, again, being the Ising and J being the XY coupling. Okay. And you diagonalize. You know, you can just do it by pen and paper. You can just do it by hand. You realize that there are six completely degenerate states, and then there's a manifold of two degenerate states. Okay? So these six states have energy minus 3j by 8, and these two states have energy 9j by 8. Okay? Now, what are these states? Okay, so the six degenerate states are nothing but up, 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 okay? Then up, down, down, plus omega. Omega is cube root of unity, so it's e to the I2 pi by 3. So up, 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 down, down, plus omega, down, up, down, plus omega square, down, down, up, and it's complex conjugate, okay? And they're Cramer's pairs. So basically, you can think of this guy, for example, as three spins that are down, And then you have a magnon. You have one spin that is flipped. And this one spin is basically jumping around on a triangle. Okay? So you can associate some sort of chirality with which direction it is jumping around. And then other than these three states, you have the Cramer space. Okay? So you flip up by down. Okay? So this is an exact six-fold degeneracy, these three states and their Cramer space. And the other two states are exactly degenerate. They are Cramer's pairs of each other. They are basically up, up, down, plus up, down, up, plus down, up, up. So there are no complex phases running around here. So the interesting thing is that at this point, at Jz by J, the ferromagnetic phase is equal to the phase, which is the 120 degree version, but the quantum 120 degree version of the 120 degree state. Okay, so the quantum version of the 120 degree state. So these states are exactly degenerate with this state. Okay? That's crucial. And this is just for a single triangle, so we haven't solved anything yet. Okay? Now, the essential idea is that you can use this spectrum to rewrite the Hamiltonian in terms of projectors that just involve these states. Okay? They do not involve anything else. They just involve projectors that involve these states. So what do I mean by that? It's a very old idea, just hasn't been done for the Kagome lattice, I guess. You write the Hamiltonian as a sum of Hamiltonians on triangular motifs. And this becomes basically 3 by 2. The coefficient is not so important. The fact that it's positive is important. 3 by 2 times P triangle minus a constant, okay, times the number of triangles. So this P triangle is nothing but the projector on a triangular motif. And remember, the projector is nothing but involving these states, plus, 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 minus, minus. Okay? So this plus, if you remember, involved three spins. Up, up, down, up, down, up, plus down, up, up. Okay? So it involved three spins on the triangle in a certain linear combination, which did not have any chirality. Right? Okay, so the projectors on triangles can be written this way. But this is not so easy as because the projectors on the triangles, they do not commute with each other. Okay? So yes, each and every Hamiltonian on a triangular motif is positive definite, but they do not commute with each other. So the solution is not so obvious to write down. Okay? So an arbitrary eigenstate on one triangle need not be compatible with the other triangles. Okay? Okay. So as I was mentioning earlier, writing this Hamiltonian as a sum of projectors, it's a very old idea, but seems to have been missed. Some other examples that have been around in the literature, starting with the Majumdar-Ghosh Hamiltonian, which is a Hamiltonian that is specific to 1D chains, where you can write a J1, J2 Hamiltonian for a certain ratio of J1 and J2 as a sum of positive definite projectors. Okay? Then there is an AKLT Hamiltonian, which is for spin 1 chains, where you have a bilinear and a biquadratic term. So the biquadratic term is SI dot SJ square, which is allowed for spin 1. That becomes exactly solvable as well. That also can be written as some positive definite projectors. Then there are more recent models by Kitaev and Wen. All of these are beautiful models. They are exactly solvable. Again, they can be written as a sum of projectors, at least in some cases. But in this case, often the projectors commute, at least for the Wen model on the plaquette, for example, involving plaquettes on a square lattice. And then there's the Shastri-Sutherland lattice also, on which you can write down some exactly solvable models. Okay, so the idea is very old, but the result, I guess, wasn't that old. Okay, so what we realized is that to make each and every projector zero, we want to annihilate this projector consistently. Okay? So because zero is the minimum energy for each one of these motifs, if we annihilate all the projectors simultaneously, we find the total ground state of the system. Okay? We find the simultaneous ground state of the system, which satisfies all these conditions. So what we did is we defined three colors. Okay? So these are quantum mechanical versions of what you think about classically. Okay? So for example, we have a color red, which we call A. which is up plus down. So this is a spin basically pointing in the x direction. Unfortunately, my labeling is not so good. So this looks like a spin in the z direction, but it's not. So this is basically the z basis. And this is a spin basically pointing in the x direction. Similarly, one can define another color up plus omega down and up plus omega square down. And these are other spins pointing in the xy plane at 120 degrees with respect to this spin. Okay? So once I do that, I can show that as long as I satisfy the condition of 1a, 1b, and 1c on every triangular motif, I get an exact solution. The solution is exact. Why is that so? So you can take up, up, up. If I just take a tensor product of these three, if I take up, 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 that is annihilated by plus, 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 minus, minus. So I should have written it, but really our Hamiltonian is something like this, plus, 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 minus, minus, right, on every triangular motif. And the plus, the up, up, up state is orthogonal to plus and orthogonal to minus. So it is annihilated by P triangle, which is what we want. Also, down, down, down is annihilated. And if you look at any of the other linear combinations, up, up, down, up, down, up, once you expand this out, you will realize that they come in sets which are annihilated by this projector, P triangle. So it's a very simple proof. You can just do it, you know, as a very simple exercise in a few minutes. But as long as we have one color per triangle, and we take a tensor product of all the colors, we have an exact eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, of the Jz equal to minus half J Hamiltonian. Okay. So now you can see that if I take a tensor product of all these, I do not conserve Sz. I break U1 symmetry of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has U1 symmetry. The Hamiltonian is S plus S minus plus S minus S plus plus Sz Sz. So that does not break U1 symmetry, does not change the number of spins, up spins and down spins, the total number of up spins and down spins in the system. So if you project this solution onto a definite Sz sector, then also you have an exact solution. So this exact solution does not exist not only for, it exists not only in one sector, it exists across all Sz sectors. It exists not only in one magnetic field, it exists in any magnetic field. Okay? So you don't have to fine tune the magnetic field or something. In any magnetic field, any filling, you will have this exact solution. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? No. Okay. So you can explicitly verify that. So what we did here is we took a 30-side system. And we diagonalized it. What I'm showing here is several momentum sectors. What I'm showing on the x-axis is different Jz. What I'm showing here also is different number of bosons or different filling, which is equivalent to putting on different magnetic field. Okay. And what I'm showing here is that this point, this special point, this Jz equal to minus half point, exists for all fillings. Okay, so here I'm showing half filling, which is Sz0, which is the antiferromagnetic sector that everyone's interested in. Here I'm showing Sz5. Here I'm showing Sz equal to 10 and Sz equal to 14, which is basically the extreme limit of this problem, because when I just have one boson, so I'm using bosons and spins interchangeably. Basically, I think of one down spin in a sea of up spins as one boson in a vacuum. So in all these cases, the exact solution exists, okay? So it exists, but what can we do with it? Okay, so I am a computational theorist, and my eyes lit up when I saw this, because this is a tremendous reduction in complexity of the problem. If I consider the number of three colorings, I see that there are still exponentially many of them, but the number of such colorings, number of three colorings, is far less than what I would have in the Ising basis. Okay? So Ising basis are just spins pointing up and down. Here the spins are pointing 120 degrees with respect to each other. But this is the quantum version of the 120 degree states. Okay? What we also did is we wanted to explain some previous results that existed in the literature. So there is a known result for the case of the non-interacting case. That is one downspin in a sea of upspins. That is just one boson in a vacuum. What it shows is that you get on the Kagome lattice, because of the topology of the Kagome lattice, you get states which are completely localized. So what I'm showing here is the amplitude and the phase of the non-interacting solution on a Kagome lattice. And what you get is basically a flat band. You get in the ground state, you do not get any dispersion of the modes. And the reason is that you have completely localized modes. So if I consider something that is if I consider something that is plus here and minus here, and if there's a process that takes a particle from, we're just thinking in the non-interacting setting. So if I take a particle from here to here and here to here, there's a perfect destructive interference. So a particle that jumps from here to here, they completely cancel with each other. So there is no amplitude for this particle here for ever leaking out. Okay? Okay? So this argument was actually used to calculate the total number of independent modes, one particle modes, on a Kagome lattice. So these are the localized modes. And then when I look at the topological modes on the torus, I get two other non-contractible loops, one in this direction and one in the other direction. Okay, because I have a two-dimensional geometry, so I have two topological modes. So the number of localized modes plus two topological modes, that is the number of states that are associated with this flat band. Okay, so that is number of unit cells plus one. Now, what I have done is I have used a completely different picture, okay, of three coloring modes. It has no resemblance to what you saw earlier, but it still explains what we record. So what we record is we record the overlap matrix of two colorings. I told you that these colorings form a basis. They are non-orthogonal and not necessarily linearly independent of each other. So you can calculate the rank of this S matrix or of this overlap matrix. And the rank tells you how many linearly independent modes there are. So the number of linearly independent modes actually matches up very well with the previous prediction when I just have one particle. Okay? When I have the non-interacting solution, which I just have one boson in a, or just one downspin in a sea of upspins, the number of modes I get on a torus geometry matches exactly with what Balance and others have predicted. However, when I add more and more bosons, that is, I add more and more downspins in the sea of upspins, there is not necessarily a perfect match between what I see from exact diagonalization and what I see from computing the rank of this S matrix. So there may be solutions, or there are solutions, that are not completely described by three colorings. Okay? And that may be because I'm seeing too many maybes, but I'm fairly sure about all my statements. That is happening because we are projecting down to some definite SG sector. So we are projecting down to some definite filling or definite number of bosons. So it is possible that you can have some violations of happening outside the color space. But once you project, these solutions also become the ground states of the XXZ Hamiltonian at J is equal to minus half J. So it's something that we are still currently exploring, but just empirically, we see that as I increase the number of bosons, which is saying as I increase the filling, or as I go closer to half filling, these violations become less and less rare. So the number of bosons, the number of linearly independent solutions that I calculate from this S matrix, from this overlap matrix, and the number I see within exact diagonalization, they perfectly match. Now, of course, I cannot go to very, very large system sizes because I get extremely large number of degeneracies. Remember, this degeneracy is going exponentially. So I cannot be 100% sure, but this is some sort of mathematical physics question lurking here, that are there, what is the representation of these solutions that are not in the coloring manifold, but that do appear when we exactly diagonalize the system? This is something I haven't been able to completely answer, and it's not super relevant for what I'm going to show, but this is something that is still exciting if you're interested in it from a mathematical viewpoint. Okay, So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip a few things and get to the central part of my talk. Okay, so rather than just focusing on one point, which everyone has been trying to understand what happens at the Heisenberg point of the Kagome antiferromagnet, I generalized the Hamiltonian a bit. So other than varying JZ, which was the XXZ, which was the Ising coupling associated with the XXZ Hamiltonian, one can also vary J2. Okay? So what I introduce is I introduce a second nearest neighbor Hamiltonian here, which also has the same JZ as the J1 part. Okay? So the interesting thing is, note that these J2s also form complete triangles. Okay? So if I write down the JZ equal to minus half J Hamiltonian for these motifs, as long as J2 is greater than zero, that's also an exact ground state of my Hamiltonian. Okay? So what I'm showing here is I need to satisfy not only these triangles having one blue, one green, one red, but also these triangles having one green, one blue, one red. And once I satisfy that, and if J2 is greater than zero, my Hamiltonian is still a sum of positive definite projectors, and this solution is still an eigenstate and an exact ground state, in fact, of my problem. As you can see, the solution that develops is actually the so-called Q equal to zero state, where each of the triangular motifs is doing exactly the same thing. You have one green, one red, one blue, green, red, blue, green, red, blue, in exactly the same order. So once you add this J2, instead of having exponentially many solutions, you actually are just left with two linearly independent solutions. Okay, so I'll just make this bit more precise. What I do is I take a large system. It has 36 sites, if you call that large, okay? And then the Hilbert space is very large. It's 63 million. We exactly diagonalize it. So here I'm showing the lattice in real space, what it looks like when we represent it on a computer. Go to reciprocal space. We measure the static structure factor. I'll just get to this in a second, but basically we just take the Fourier transform of real spin correlations to see any abrupt changes in phases. We also record the fidelity. So the fidelity is basically nothing but the overlap between wave functions, between nearby wave functions in wave function space or in parameter space, okay? So these are the sort of metrics that we use to diagnose what sort of stuff is happening in our phase diagram. So just for the static structure factor, if I have a Q equal to zero state, so I have spin up here, 120 degree, 120 degree, spin up here, 120, 120, and here this, I have an enlarged unit cell of nine sites, which is called the root three by root three. I take the Fourier transform of these pure classical states, I expect to see this. So what I'm showing is I'm showing the triangular Brillouin zone, the first Brillouin zone, and I'm showing that the structure factor has strong peaks at the so-called endpoints, which are the midpoints of these hexagons, okay? And when I have the root three by root three state, the weight is transferred onto the K points, okay? So these are the classical phases where I expect to see these two patterns, okay? But we are interested in the quantum case, and this is, I would say, the most important take-home message you should take from this talk. Okay, so there's a lot of stuff happening here, and let me just go over it very, very slowly. On one axis, we have J2. Just to remind you, J2 was the next nearest coupling on the Kagome lattice. This was J2. This is J2. This is J1. As I said, this fine-tuned point, this special point, is at JZ equal to minus half, okay, and J2 equal to zero. Okay, this special point. For a single triangular motif, I have shown that the ferromagnet and the 120 degree states should be exactly degenerate at this point. But that was just for a single triangular motif. That logic gets extended even when you go to an extended Kagome lattice on a 36 site. So around this point, you see that there's a perfect degeneracy between the ferromagnet, the Q equal to zero classical state, the root three by root three classical state, okay? But in addition to these three classical sort of ordered states, these three magnetically long range ordered states, We also find there is a sliver which is supporting something else, okay? Okay, so let me go over those a bit slowly. So these classical states, these phase boundaries, as you change J2, positive, can be understood exactly. You can write down the exact equation of this line. You can write down an approximate equation even for this line, because you're basically just comparing energy of two classical phases. This is all at zero temperature. Okay? However, these lines that separate a classical phase, classical Q equal to zero, or very semi-classical Q equal to zero phase, and this very quantum-like, what we believe is a spin liquid, is hard to get analytically. But this is our extrapolated sort of inference by measuring the height of these peaks. So I showed you that if I have an ordered state, these heights are very, very sharp. Okay, but as I go closer, as I reduce J2, the height decreases. Now, wherever the height decreases rapidly, you know, as a function of this parameter, or wherever the fidelity, the wave function fidelity decreases rapidly, is what we indicate by the star that we see here. Similarly, you can do it in this direction when J2 is negative. Okay, so the peaks are very sharp because you're in a classical phase. But as you go towards positive, as you go less negative J2, you see that there's some abrupt phase transition. Okay, so there is possibly a spin liquid here. There is possibly a spin liquid here, but we are only on 36 sites. However, one should really view our results in the context of other DMRG results that existed. So other DMRG results existed at the Heisenberg point. So as I said, this is JZ. This is our special point. This is JZ equal to 1, which is the Heisenberg point, which people have studied very, very extensively. So these are the known DMRG phase boundaries. I got them from a paper by Schallwerk, which I quote sort of in the next slide. And what has been argued is that there is one spin liquid living here, and it is flanked by a classical, semi-classical phase here, that's the Q equal to zero state, and another semi-classical phase here, which is the root 3 by root 3 phase. However, what our phase diagram shows is that all these phases are coming from, have some common origin. They're coming from this point that is controlling everything that we are seeing here. Okay? Now, one other interesting point that has been not so appreciated is that even though these structure factors do not show any sharp peaks, they do have some structure at large momentum. Okay? At large momentum means in real space, there are some short-range correlations which are different between these states. Okay? And we suggest that there is a phase transition even between these two states, which have different looking structure factors at large momentum. That is, they have different looking structure factors at, or very different looking spin correlations at very short length scales. Okay? So if you believe this picture, you should ask the question, OK, what may these two be in a more analytical framework? Okay? But I want to just develop a little bit more evidence for that this may not be so crazy. So this is, we did it for 36 sites, but there is other DMRG work for larger system sizes. And once again, you see that at J2 equal to 0, there's some sort of diffuse structure which is not so prominent. But if you go to J2 equal to 0.1, these peaks exist. These are similar to the peaks I'm showing here. Well, they are not genuine thermodynamic, they are not genuine peaks, but there is some structure associated with them, which is not going completely to zero. This peak height is not going to completely to zero. It's not increasing with system size, but it's also not going to zero. So that is remnant of some short-range order in the system. So what I'm saying is that even on the larger clusters, you see something qualitatively similar. That is where Schallwerk and co-workers expect a DMRG spin, a spin liquid to exist within DMRG. You see some short-range correlations, which is you see some structure at large momentum. Okay. Now, if you look at how they monitored the structure factor peak, I'm so sorry, it's not so clear. I just got it from the paper, but you see that there is something funny happening around J2 equal to 0. So this line is J2 equal to 0 marked by me. Here they have plotted the height of the structure factor, which is M of Q. And as a function of various system sizes, so this is various, so in DMRG, I should have been more specific, but in DMRG, basically, people have cylinders of length L and width W. So here they have width 6. These are the YC6 cylinders. And they are going to larger and larger length. So they fix the width. They're going to larger and larger length. And it still seems that the structure factor, the height of the peaks, has not gone to completely zero for the largest system size they have. But clearly, there's something different happening around J2 equal to 0 on both sides of this line, of this J2 equal to 0 line. So if you believe that there is some low-lying, there is some structure at large momentum, small length scales, then you can ask the question, what are these two states? Well, the answer was given by Subir Sachdev in 1992 when he was exploring this in a mean field sort of perspective, doing Schwinger bosons. And what he found at the Schwinger boson level was that the Q1 equal to Q2, so these are two parameters parameterizing the mean field fluxes that enter the Schwinger boson formalism, which in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into. But essentially, what he plotted out was the structure factor as a function of k. And unfortunately, this has gone a little missing. But this is basically the peak at the k points. And this is the peak at the m points. So what he found within a mean field framework was that there are two spin liquid states which are very, very close in energy. And if you believe this story by Schoenberg that there is some remnant order possibly surviving in the system, then our suggestion doesn't look so crazy. What we are saying is that there are two spin liquids instead of one spin liquid in this sliver, and they basically have short-range correlations which are very, very different looking. Okay, and these survive not only at Jz equal to 1, but this phase transition should be seen at any Jz. And this line continues all the way to the special point. So that is the crux of, or that is the central point of our picture. Okay, so I should really put things in perspective, because this may not be the word on the Kagome lattice, but it seems a very compelling explanation of everything that people have seen, or lots of things that people have seen. However, there have been more recent sophisticated tensor network type algorithms, also DMRG, but with different sorts of analysis looking for Dirac cones, which are the signature of U1 or gapless spin liquid behavior. And there are at least two camps that tend to suggest that this may be true. However, you can see that they are far from certain. As they say, our result, therefore, is certainly not the final answer to the long-standing question. So it's still a bit controversial problem. I should also mention the earlier work by Yasir Iqbal and Federico Becca, who basically pushed this very far with variational Monte Carlo and additional numerics on top of it. I would say that this was the end of the story, but Xiaogang Wen actually put out a very recent paper from Perimeter, actually, arguing that the Kagome lattice actually flows to a Z2 fixed point in a tensor network sort of formalism. He used tensor renormalization group. At this point, I would just like to leave it here and just say that our paper is not trying to solve this problem definitively in the same way that other people are trying. Rather, we are asking the question, what are the phases around it? Now, I'd just like to leave you with one idea, that the idea that you can have Hamiltonians which stabilize many quantum states, exponentially many quantum states, all have the same energy, even quantum mechanically, seems to be fairly new. Yuan Wan here has been working on it from a semi-classical perspective. What we did in our paper was we worked out which Hamiltonian on another kind of lattice, the pyrochlore lattice, which is also a lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra, gives a ground state where all the four coloring states are exact ground states. And actually, it turns out that this particular Hamiltonian, which is not as nice as just the two-body Hamiltonian, it involves four-body terms, this Hamiltonian is also close to another known spin liquid on the pyroclore lattice and also the square lattice. So with that, I will just end my talk, and I'll say that we've developed, we believe, a new perspective for looking at this very old problem. Instead of just focusing on the Heisenberg point, we have tried to understand where are these spin liquids emerging from. And given the existence of this point, we have tried to understand all the phases around it. The central other key feature of this phase diagram is that there are possibly two spin liquids that exist in this sliver. And this is not so crazy, because even at the Schwinger boson level, even at the mean field level, there has been evidence that these two phases are extremely close in energy. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'm sorry for going over time, but it started a little bit late. Thank you. Yeah.
It's time for questions. I guess I'll start. So if we believe the SLA and SLB are related to the two kinds of spin liquid states composed by Sugger.
Yes.
One is Q1 equals Q2, another is Q1 equals minus Q2, which doesn't meet a nice representation in terms of Schwinger bosons. So I was just wondering to what extent, so from a physical diagram, it seems that all these states are they stem from this special degeneracy point. So I was wondering whether there's a way to connect these spin liquid states to the exponentially degenerate coloring states at the degeneracy point.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I believe I've only given a partial answer, right? Because currently, I mean, within this projector formalism, all I can understand is the classically ordered states, right? I mean, when J2 is positive, I know that I have an exact solution here. Now, what you're asking is a very hard question. I don't know how to think of a spin liquid as a superposition of coloring wave functions. Essentially, that's what you're asking. You're asking if I project, if I take, I rewrite my spin liquid as a sum of, just like you can write down a spin liquid as a sum of dimer coverings in the Anderson language, you can ask the analogous question, can a spin liquid be written down as a sum of three coloring states?
Yes.
Well, I think it's a bit tricky because these three coloring states are not connected by the perturbation. What do I mean by that? I'm being a bit vague here. So if I go to this point, right, and I add, I think of SZ, the JZ term, I think of JZ plus half. How do I, maybe can I push this on? If I think of JZ plus half SZ, right? I think of it as a perturbation around the XXZ0 point, then these perturbations basically take me outside the coloring manifold. So I would have to go to very high order perturbation theory, maybe third order perturbation theory, till I get, till I can come back to the coloring manifold. So what I'm saying is this high order perturbation theory near this very, very highly degenerate point, it's something that we've tried, but we have not been very successful with it. That doesn't mean that it cannot work. But I think that is probably essential to understanding how should I think of these spin liquids when I project to just this three coloring manifold. And that's some technical barrier that we haven't been able to cross. So we did the numerics and try to understand the functional, or try to understand the relationship of all these observed states in the vicinity of this point. But that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer right now.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Are there any other indications of topological order for these two states and spin liquids?
Yeah, that's another excellent question. So I spent the first half of my talk bragging that, hey, I found this low energy manifold. It's completely gapped from the rest of the states. I can do this flux pumping experiment, etc. To the best of my knowledge, no one has been able to find that topological manifold, whether it be with DMRG or exact diagnosis or any sophisticated technique. No one has been able to isolate that manifold of low energy states, which is predicted. So if it's a Zeto spin liquid on the torus, you expect there to be four low energy states, but no one has been able to identify those yet. However, there is a proposal by Wen, the proposal by Wen says that, so I don't understand TRG in all its complete glory, but there's a proposal that says that they can essentially determine the topological order by calculating the modular matrices directly in this framework. So I'm just saying that the only paper that says something positive about it is this particular paper by Wen. To the best of my knowledge, they also cannot isolate a manifold, but they have some indirect way of calculating the modular matrices. So because no one has seen all these four states nicely gapped out from the rest of the spectrum, there has been some recent sentiment that it may be associated with a gapless spin liquid. So that's something that is, again, so if it's a gapless spin liquid, you won't see these nice properties that I described in the first part of the talk. And how to measure, how to detect a U1 spin liquid directly in numerics, I don't know the answer yet, but you guys are theorists. You can tell me how to do it. And yeah, maybe I can. We can talk more about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank you for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.